Judiciary Committee. We apparently have a new copy of our masterpiece. I don't think it's going to win any awards. Unless you like sausage. Council's going to walk us through some of this. There's two issues I want to raise today, and I think Representative Clark is, we're currently mulling over a civil rights section to preserve the sacred rights of our citizenry is provided for in our Constitution of this country and of the state of Oregon. It's going to be one of our issues for the day, and I also want to make sure that we raise an issue that Mr. Nichols has talked about, apparently the police agree to, involving federal firearms, and then the issue of why we can only have a two-year permit and not make it a four-year permit with some kind of intervening. I want it on the record what the reason is. And if we're convinced that there's a legitimate concern why we can't have a four-year permit, I'm going to be looking at trying to grandfather in all the current permits so those people don't have to go down and blow $50 or $30, at least for a couple of years. That's some of the, just the breath.
Can council remind us sort of what we got accomplished and what we left hanging last time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think most issues have been gone over at least once at this point. That's why it would be my recommendation that we just do spend about probably 10 minutes walking through the Dash 10 amendments, and it's as close to the final form as we're going to get. There are some issues that have to be raised, but I think that by going through the bill, reviewing it in its new form, we kind of set the stage for that. We have been through my working document and completed that, so the initial issues have all been addressed. It's just now a question of fine-tuning. Okay.
Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in that case, I will begin. Section 1 of the Dash 10 amendments is the definition section of the new bill. At the request of the working group, a definition of antique firearms was added, and that's new language that now shows up on page 1. There is some question as to whether or not all the sections that have been referenced that will exempt antique firearms from the provision of this bill, so that is something that we will be checking.
Council, this is the same definition as federal law, is that right?
That's correct. And in my conversations with legislative council this morning, we weren't sure if the exemptions went through the bill completely, and so that has to be clarified before our final work session. Just for the committee's information, if you now, in thinking back to the original bill and where we started, the major change in the definition section was the inclusion of a definition of misdemeanor of violence. Section 2 deals with the issue of sale of handguns. There is a lot of new language in there in terms of what information has to be obtained, the 15-day waiting period. At Representative Mannix's request, the forms were taken out and just indications done that this had to be done in triplicate. There's the triplicate copy that has the thumbprints that goes to the state police for the criminal records check. I would point out to the committee that on page 4, beginning at line 10, is the committee's efforts to strengthen the provisions of the unlawful activity. If the state or local government compiles or maintains any of this information, and then the issue that was raised by Representative Clark in terms of a civil action would begin on line 17. Mr. Chair, do you want me to just go through this and then you can come back to your issues if you want to start? It would be my recommendation that we just go through it once so that everyone just gets a handle on what we're doing.
Let's do that. I believe Representative Clark is conferring with his...
My staff person will be gone in about 5 minutes, Mr. Chair.
Oh, we enjoy it.
Yeah, I do too, but it's going to be tough to get anything done. She will be gone in about 5 minutes.
She's welcome.
Okay. And helping you draft the little civil rights section.
Right.
Other things that changes that have been incorporated as this has evolved, in the handgun application, the new language talks about two pieces of current identification, one of which must bear a photograph of the purchaser. There was some discussion about what kind of identification that would have to be, but the committee never took any formal action in terms of specifying that any further. the next couple of pages is what the forms would need to look like for the purchase of a handgun. On page 7, beginning on line 23, was a declaration that the chair asked to be added. It actually got a little bit broader than we had originally discussed, but says that I hereby declare that I am not prohibited from purchasing a gun or have been granted relief. This language, or almost identical language, is included in the concealed weapons license form as well, and that was one reason why it ended up looking like this. That's page 7, lines 23 through 27. Section 3, beginning on page 9, talks about prohibition of sales of firearms and contains the list of persons who would be prohibited under this act. Those persons convicted of a felony, convicted of a misdemeanor involving violence with a 4-year window. The new mental health language is in here, beginning on page 9, which was a person who was committed to the mental health division within 6 years prior to the effective date of the act, or beginning on line 11, after the effective date of this act was found to be mentally ill and subject to a commitment order that would prohibit the person from purchasing the gun.
Counsel, what page? What?
I'm on page 10.
Oh, I thought you said page 9.
Oh. The new language, the new mental health language, begins on page 9 and goes through 14.
Line 9.
Line 9.
That's where we got in trouble before.
Okay. Also, just to update the committee information, for the committee's information, the provision that begins on line 15 has been convicted of a crime, an element of which is the use of alcohol or controlled substances, or an offense contained in the Uniform Controlled Substance Act, was derived from the original bill that talked about a person being a chronic abuser of alcohol or substance abuse. Section.
Where's that section again, Council?
Line 15, page 10. Section 4 is a conformance section, talks changing ex-convicts to felons. In that section as well, on page 11, there had originally been an exemption for marijuana convictions that has been deleted. Now, section 5 is the mental health reporting section. You will find in your packets of material that was put together today new language that has been proposed by the Oregon Psychological Association, which is an effort to change the requirements under Section 5. To summarize, and then we'll need to come back to this, basically, the new Section 5 does on your sheet of paper dated May 26 is takes out all the reporting requirements for the public facilities, because those persons would all be because the person would be civilly committed, it was really duplicative, and then incorporates all the reporting provisions under 412, Senate Bill 412, and sets up the reporting system that way. I have reviewed this with the proponents of the measure. I think it is the cleanest way to go to date, and in fact I think makes sense given the fact that the way that the committee has handled the civil commitment issues. There is one policy issue in here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
On this question, I had a lengthy discussion with Dr. Bloom the other day, and I really would like to hear the Psychological Association's comments and testimony on where we are vis-a-vis mental health reporting and that whole issue, because I know, right. When we get to that point, I'd like to.
Making a list and checking it twice.
Yeah.
At least.
Okay, we then go to Section 6, which begins on page 14. Section 6 just adds misdemeanors of violence as those crimes that have to be reported to the central reporting computer.
Where's that at, Council?
Page 14 and 15. That just adds in misdemeanors of violence for the computer checks, basically. Section 7 repeals the current CCW statutes, and beginning with Section 8 is the new statutes that will deal with the issuance of concealed weapons licenses. as the committee goes through the next couple of pages of that, you will notice that most of the decisions that were made regarding prohibited persons under handgun purchases are also reflected in here. Now, in terms of change from current law to new policy in this measure, there are increased fees and there is an increased period of time that the permit is approved, or good for, I guess. Now, we then flip to page 19, section 9. Section 9 is the steps that will occur or the things that will happen if the application for a license is approved. And section 9A is what happens if the application is denied. In the evolving bill, the steps that one had to go through if there was either an approval or a denial was in the same section of the bill. It got a little confusing to track it. So based on my conversations with legislative counsel, we created one section that deals specifically with approval, and then 9A, which is on page 20, deals with license denials. If you'll see, for example, in 9A, the sheriff must set forth the reasons in writing. You have days time to appeal, and you can kick into the appellate process. Section 10 deals with licenses which are renewable. Now, Section 11, then, on page 21, is the court review process. This has been significantly modified from the original bill, and it was also modified as a result of discussions from work sessions two work sessions ago. And just to refresh the committee's memory, persons who are denied purchase or possession file in a local court, either a justice court or municipal court. A person who is denied a concealed handgun license would go to district court. A person whose name is placed on the mental health registry would go to the district court. There was an attempt to make this as informal as possible, and so there's a lot of language on page 22 which reviews or sets that up. The relief section begins on line 20 on page 22. And then when we get to line page 23, there have been two issues that were raised. And these were raised, I believe, by Bill Linden from the State Court Administrator's Office. The first issue was there seems to be some disagreement about how much filing fees will be if you end up going into district court, whether it's the same $25 or whether or not if you're automatically going into district court on a concealed weapons license if you pay normal district court fees. That issue has to be resolved. And also, based on Mr. Linden's discussions with Chief Joseph, they have new language that they would like considered in terms of the Court of Appeals. So that's something else that the committee has to come back to.
Let me bring that up today, Council. We can get through that real fast.
Yeah. That's section 12. Section 13 is the amendment of current law that talks about the unlawful possession of a firearm. Given the fact that this section has been significantly revamped and some comments that I've had with Diane Luther and others, it may be necessary to put not make this section retroactive, because there are people in here who could be, because of the misdemeanor of violence section, which says that you would be prohibited within 4 years, and because of the mental health provision, I think that you run into what Marla Ray would call an ex post facto problem. And so I think the committee is going to have to address that issue.
Can we take about a 1 minute break? I don't want to miss out on all the action here.
We're going to hold you to 60 seconds.
For about 30 seconds of where we were at so we can get back on track here.
Seems to me we were in the court review section, or maybe I was, oh no. We were in section 13, which has to do with the crime of unlawful possession of a firearm if a person knowingly has one and are on that list. And I was raising with the committee the issue that because there are parts of that provision that have windows that go backwards, that the committee may want to consider some sort of this is not going to affect until after the effective date of the act, because let me, because otherwise I think you're going to run into legal problems.
Okay, then. Council, you want to do a little recess here? You know,
I'm almost done.
We're going to run into legal problems during this meeting, Council.
Because there are new provisions in Section 13 that will make it a crime for something that has happened in the past, because your misdemeanor convictions can be considered for 4 years because of your felon and your commitment issue, people who are currently legally possessing guns are all of a sudden going to be illegally possessing guns, and I think that there's an issue there that has to be resolved.
And that's what section are we looking at, Council?
Section 13. See, felons currently are prohibited, so there's not a problem there. But the concern is because of misdemeanors of violence, because of the retroactivity of some of this, the issue of retroactive application has to be researched, and I think that it can be cleaned up, but it has to be checked. Now, sections 13A and sections 15 and 16 and 17 are all new crimes dealing with attempted purchase and business practices and other kinds of crimes involving the use of guns. And those are all new criminal acts that are being created within this bill. Section 18 is the new sentencing section. Based on the committee's recommendations last time and my discussions with legislative counsel, the actions that were taken is that we took the current minimum sentence statutes that exists at 161.610 and added, basically built onto it, some of the stuff that was contained in Section 10 so that you currently have minimums of 5 and 10 years on first convictions unless you use machine guns, short-barreled rifles, etc., at which point your minimums are 10 and 20 years. And the other change that was made in the current law based on the direction given to council and legislative council was that we deleted, there was a discretionary sentencing provision in 161.610 that we took out. So basically what we did was we took the strong parts of Section 18 and strengthened 161.610.
Council?
Yeah.
Can you remind us of the discussion and more importantly, the resolution of the discussion about Section, the one you just went through, Section 18,
mm-hmm.
minimum sentencing and all that, in relationship to sentencing guidelines?
As my understanding, sentencing guidelines has, the Sentencing Guidelines Board has passed a resolution or taken a position that all current statutory mandatory minimums will be honored.
Is this
so
current?
So this will supersede sentencing guidelines.
Because they don't become effective till September.
Not only because they don't become effective till September, but any statute that currently exists that sets a mandatory minimum will take precedence over sentencing guidelines. And we have added two current statutes.
So your position is that we're simply amending current statutory minimums,
correct.
Not creating new ones.
Correct.
And as a matter of legislative
enhancing
history,
them.
Yeah, okay.
And enhancing them, which will also ensure that these will be followed rather than in lieu of sentencing guidelines.
Okay.
Council, what guarantee do we have of that, given that we've got 4 days.
There is the public record on the Sentencing Guidelines Board. There's also language in the Sentencing Guideline Rules that say very clearly that all Oregon statutes that set mandatory minimums take precedent over sentencing guidelines.
Those are the rules that could be changed.
Well, Mr. Chair, one thing we could do, we have at least two more Senate bills coming through Judiciary on sentencing guidelines, and I see no reason why we couldn't put a...
You should probably say coming to Judiciary.
Coming to Judiciary. Whether they will come through Judiciary or not, I guess, is... But we could certainly put an amendment in one of those bills, just clarifying the relationship between these minimum sentences. It would be a little bit out of place, but it'd be entirely appropriate. It would be law, not rules.
Or you can also put it in here.
We can put some
language in here saying notwithstanding rules adopted by.
Let's come back to that, Council.
You'll note on page 28, sections 19 and 20 were deleted. Sections 19 and 20 were needed because of what section 18 originally did, and when we modified section 18, that was no longer necessary. Section 21, section 22, section 23 are basically conformance sections. Section 24 has to do with changing, altering, removing, and obliterating identification numbers of any firearms. This section has been discussed intermittently throughout our work sessions. It has been brought to my attention that there is still a problem with this, and that there are certain kinds of firearms that one may legitimately need to change an identification number.
I would like to flag that section.
So I have flagged it, this problem. This section does need some additional work. 25 and 26, 27 are all conformance. 28 is conformance. 29 is the new study section that has been the only significant amendment that the committee has made to the study section to date was the removal of the requirement that thumbprints be taken for the purpose of the study on the sale of long arms. That is out of here. Section 31, page 36, is new language that the committee added that talked about destruction of documents, destruction of the duplicate and triplicate sheets. So that's new language that has been added. Sections 33 and 34 and 35 were added as a result of the new court review process. What those sections do is just give the necessary courts, the justice courts, the municipal courts, and the district courts the authority to hear the reviews that are established under this bill. And section 36 is the new language that also came about as a result of section 5, amending the civil commitment statutes to get the kinds of orders that would prohibit a person from purchasing or possessing a firearm. There has been, Mr. Linden, the state court administrator, has been looking at this language and discussing that with his bosses to get some reaction from them about that. And that updates us on the current dash 10 amendments.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Given that it's a quarter till 10, seems to me that we ought to pick one issue and try and get it done today rather than squirrel around on two or three. I don't see realistically that we're going to have a chance to do much more than that today.
The first one that came up in here is the, if we're ready to go on it at this time, if not, we can hold off, is the commencement of civil action.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to invite the representatives from law enforcement to come to the table and we can have a discussion on the record, and then I'll make a proposal and a statement. Gentlemen, the question of a private right of action for violation of provisions of the Act is currently found where, Council? Page 5?
Page 4,
line 17.
Thank you.
And kind of what I'd like to do is reproduce the discussion we had a few minutes ago. I'll ask the first question. I understand that the law enforcement community generally is not supportive of the subsection B there. Any person may commence a civil action to compel any state or local agency to perform the duties imposed by this paragraph. If the plaintiff prevails, the court shall award the plaintiff reasonable attorney fees incurred in bringing the action and any appeal of the judgment. That follows a section which charges a public employee who intentionally violates this act with a Class C felony. The first question I want to ask you on the record is, would it make any difference to your frustration with the private right of action if we took out the Class C felony. Seems to me that that would be the one that would be more onerous, and the private right of action simply brings this statute into parallel with some other charges we give law enforcement agencies in terms of discrimination statutes and that sort of thing. So which is worse, the Class C felony or the private right of action? And either, anybody can answer that question from your perspective.
Chairman, Sheriff Burks, for the record, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I think that we felt that the prohibitions here, first of all, were at question. The prohibition of keeping the records locally, because in the work committee we had agreed that it should be prohibited on a statewide basis of keeping a compilation of all of the sales of firearms. But currently, local and county organizations do keep those records, and for some very legitimate purposes, we think. And I think that's, first of all, where we run into a problem, and that we need to discuss that for a period of time. As far as the sanctions go for violations of the section, if there is a section there, I think that the law enforcement agencies would be more comfortable with the sanction of a crime as opposed to the civil rights violation. I think law enforcement is very concerned about civil rights violations, and particularly when you start stacking them up. First of all, you're charged with a felony, which you could go to the penitentiary for. You obviously are going to lose your job upon conviction. And lastly, someone's going to take you on for civil rights and own everything you have by the time you get through that process. So I think we're very concerned about the stacking of the sanctions, if you will. But the underlying issue, I believe, that we're really concerned about is the keeping of local records.
Okay. Patriot, do you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I would only state that originally when the working group sat down to discuss this particular issue, it was thought that what we wanted to avoid was a central repository of gun registrations, and that was centered at the state police. And the working group agreed that that is where we would prohibit compilation of those records, but it did not have the intent, the working group that is, to affect local agencies that have that right now to retain those records and to utilize those for some very valid functions.
Do you think that Section 2 as it's currently written affects that ability?
I do, Representative Clark. I think it should specify the Oregon State Police.
Okay. If that's the case, then I guess I need to back up a little bit, because apparently we did something with Section 2 that I at least did not know that law enforcement was uncomfortable with. And let's set that aside for a minute. If Section 2 reflected the working group's understanding, if we were to change Section 2 to reflect the working group's understanding of the prohibition on compiling a registry of information, then what I'm trying to get at it is my original idea was simply if a state agency violates the provisions of this act, particularly as it relates to keeping a central registry of information, what happens then? And the act as the bill as it originally came to us was silent on that. It said it shall be unlawful. Well, that doesn't do anything for anybody. And so what I was trying to do was simply say somebody can go into court to get a court order to say, undo what you just did, destroy those records, tear that up, whatever. It wasn't my intent to prohibit local agencies from doing what they're already able to do, and it certainly wasn't my intent to stack on to the Class C felony. I just, in my own mind as a lawyer, thought what's going to be most effective in terms of remedying a wrong in the event that it happens. And I'm not even wed to the idea of all sorts of flaming language about constitutional rights violations. I just want
a private citizen to be able to go in and get a court order that says, agency, you destroy the records that you've unlawfully compiled. But otherwise, the section seems to me to be meaningless. So can I get your reaction to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, from the state police's viewpoint, and I believe other law enforcement agencies represented here, there's a connotation with Class C felony that represents that there's some intent or knowledge on behalf of the agency to purposely compile that information, and we attribute that directly to the felony. And we believe that that should, and feel that that is appropriate for this type of situation. However, the civil liabilities may apply to a situation where there is no intent, and through perhaps some unfortunate reason, there is a mistake made. Well, then that would render the agency liable, not only civilly, but also criminally, and it could result in the officer losing his job, being charged with a felony, and imposed.
Not if we take the felony out. I'm asking you to assume that we were able to take the Class C felony out.
They're about to become subject to this.
Okay, thank you. That broadens the net even further. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am now satisfied.
Representative, what I'm going to do is personally move the handwritten amendments or the typed amendments. I'm going to move them with it. I'm going to move them with a 10-day.
We'd like to argue for a longer period of time for purposes of protection of the psychotherapist. We really would.
For the 30-day time period.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we have some comments, Mr. Chair, from the law enforcement community on these? Do you have a chance to review these? Do you have any comments? Or John Nichols or anyone who has from the working group?
To me, this is Senate Bill 412. First paragraph is Senate Bill 412. It's difficult, Mr. Chair, where the two bills are in separate bills and in separate subcommittees, but are integral parts of this approach.
I feel like a hole is being created. I'm not real comfortable with that.
Actually, you're not. Actually, you're filling a hole. Mm-hmm. Explaining it very well. If you think that there's a hole being created, then
I don't think we're finished with this issue. Let me put it that way.
Whether or not this amendment.
I fully expect us to come back and revisit this issue at the next meeting.
And there will never be. There will only be acquiescence to the way that this issue was resolved. There will never be agreement. That's an accurate statement. There will only be acquiescence.
I think if we have no opposition, I know the Speaker's office is in favor of this. Our mental health people are in favor of it. And if there's no opposition to the amendment, with a 30-day time period chosen.
And the deletions of the necessary sections in here.
Deletion of necessary sections as per the written amendment.
What about the 10-year issue, Mr. Chair, going from 10 to 6 to be more consistent with civil commitments?
Council, can we also go with
for the list?
Yes.
I think that would probably be appropriate.
Yeah, we're going to go with a 6-year time period. Everybody understand the amendment?
The issue is not closed as far as I'm concerned. I'll support the motion, but I need some convincing before we put a bow on it.
Adopted. Good. We have Mr. Linden here. We don't have much time, so we're going to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I don't want me to make you guys all have to sit together, but in case we need you, you avoid trips this way. Mr. Linden, could you please come forward?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden, State Administrator. There are two issues that I wanted to comment on. The first one is in Section 11 of the Dash 10 amendments.
Page 23.
When I met with you earlier in the week in this subcommittee, I promised to consult with Chief Judge Joseph concerning the standard of review in these matters in the Court of Appeals. It's his recommendation that the standard of review at the Court of Appeals level be what is termed the substantial evidence standard, which is found in ORS Chapter 184, which basically provides that if there is substantial evidence on the record, the court will rule accordingly in affirming the action of the lower tribunal. Since we have de novo review at the first two stages in the district, municipal, or justice court, and then at the district or circuit court level, the substantial evidence standard at the Court of Appeals level is the one that I would recommend to you. It is similar to the standard used in reviewing non-contested administrative appeals from the various agencies.
Now we're trying to turn this basically into administrative law, saying that if they have substantial evidence on the record, which is sometimes translated to any evidence to support the agency finding, we're going to back whatever they did.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The problem we'd run into in this appeal process as it came up to the Court of Appeals is that if we were to use the standard of in the same manner as other civil actions, we're talking about errors of law. And I don't think these decisions are going to rise or fall on errors of law. They're going to rise and fall on whether the evidence provided at the hearings in the lower tribunals was substantial and significant and provided the foundation for a rational decision. So I think actually it's going to give a better standard of review than if we just use an error of law standard, because again, there's not much that can come up as an error of law. So it was, anyway, that's the recommendation we have. I think it would be more meaningful in terms of a standard than to leave it the way it is, which just says in the same manner as any other civil action. Well, there'll be three levels of appeal, two of them de novo. I guess we're presuming that by the time it's up to the Court of Appeals level, the evidence is going to be relatively well developed at the two lower levels, and the court will have the option of reviewing the evidence to assure it's substantial. The only other option would be de novo at the Court of Appeals level, which I just don't think is the least bit appropriate.
I would just, is this the only issue we have to raise today? We have one more.
Well, there was one other quick one. I just received the language this morning, but it's on page 39, new section D, that requires, as I read it, that in every civil commitment proceeding, there'd be a new issue brought in, and that is whether or not the court is going to prohibit the person as a result of the person's mental or psychological state from purchasing or possessing a firearm. 99% of our civil commitments, the person allegedly incompetent or in need of commitment is represented by court-appointed counsel. This would be a new issue injected into those proceedings. What I've told the proponents I would do, and I've only had a chance to check with one judge so far this morning, is find out how likely it is that in any instance in which they're committing someone, they'd be inclined to find that that person ought to be able to possess a firearm. I talked with Judge Hargreaves, who's handling civil commitments these days in Lane County, and he said he couldn't think of an instance in which, if he's during the commitment process in the hearing, committing someone, that he would think there'd be any likelihood that he'd not find that they shouldn't. That's a double negative.
They're always going to be prohibited.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm going to check half a dozen other counties and see if there's going to be much of an expectation that we're going to have.
It makes a certain amount of common sense. You're going to commit somebody to say this person's dangerous to himself or society. We got to get him off the streets, and you know, but it's okay for him to have a gun.
Yeah. It just seems to be a little bit inconsistent. Now, whether or not that's a less onerous burden than a presumption that they, in all cases, can't get them, I don't know, but I think I'm going to hear from the judges that they don't think it happened too often. Those were the two issues, Mr. Chairman. That's true. My recollection was that the concealed weapon cases would go into district courts at the regular filing fee. And I thought that the other types of cases going into Union Justice Courts would be at the $25 fee, but there is some confusion, and Representative Mannix isn't here, but I spoke with him yesterday. He thought it'd be the regular filing fee across the board.
Filing fee into district court?
Yeah, that was his recollection, and I don't have any problems with that. I just didn't remember. He and I had different recollections. You want regular filing fees in district court?
I can't see any reason.
Okay.
I'll move that. Any objection? Adopted. Given the options, we can address this. I had just a person.
Scope of review or the civil commitment stuff?
The scope of review first.
Okay, let's.
I'll just say I personally have never been comfortable with the agency review standards, and I've been trying to stay away from that. If the committee voted throughout this, because I don't like. The expert below's finding, Ackham. In this case, I don't even know if the people below are. I'm not going to support a substantial evidence. I would, although apparently is at least doable and consistent.
That's not what the bill does, though, currently.
Yes.
Chairman, Milton, does the Court of Appeals currently hear anything else de novo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, just a very few matters now that after the 87 legislature eliminated de novo review in workers' comp cases. There's a few types of juvenile proceedings and some types of domestic relations proceedings that are heard de novo. But the de novo jurisdiction of the court was significantly reduced after workers' comp was taken out.
Mr. Chair, can I just I just state as somebody who does some appellate practice, and I can't think of anybody less qualified to do de novo review than Court of Appeals judges. And that's not a slam on the Court of Appeals judges. That's not what they do. What they do is puff on their pipe and think about points of law. And all of a sudden you're asking them to change their entire focus and dig in to questions of evidence and facts. And the few experiences I've had with de novo review in the Court of Appeals were disastrous. I mean, people came away saying, these guys never studied evidence. I mean, that was the feeling that the lawyers in my office had.
Personally, see, I kind of thought there would be some questions on law to raise, for instance, this community involved in violence, something that they were kind of made. If the person had a criminal history, whether there was some kind of violence in the door jam or something, you know, is that a misdemeanor? Should that be construed as a misdemeanor of violence? I thought it would be really tough to fight that and have to go up on the board. I didn't have any problem with just a normal civil court standard, but if it's going to make the world better, we should never do something like that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there definitely are some legal issues in this bill that will have to get resolved at some point by the appellate courts. In your average case, if there is such a thing, I think that the petitioner is going to have a more meaningful review under the substantial evidence standard than under the error of law standard, because once you've resolved the legal issues,
2 years from now,
yeah,
5 years from now,
and it's going to be a few years before that's done. Once those issues are resolved,
there won't be any
then
questions
if it
of law.
Comes up on the Court of Appeals on an error of law, I
there
think it's pretty meaningful.
There won't be. In other words, all the legal issues will be resolved by the appellate courts by that point.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, our bottom line on this, if we have one, is simply that we do not want to see an expansion of de novo review, and I'd be happy to further explore other standards of review that maybe what I'll do is just identify them, outline them in a letter to the committee, and you can take your choice.
All of the witnesses.
Now close the work session on House Bill 3470. You have a couple of minutes? Close the meeting.
When do you want to try to meet again? Kelly's been willing to meet Tuesday night.
Schedule this one the next time we get to.